Mr. Rogers, are you ready to proceed?
I am.
And sir, would you like to reserve some rebuttal time?
No, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
You know, life can be cruel, and growing old can be very, very hard, as some of us know, not you.
I won't take judicial notice of that.
This was a long marriage, over 20 years. Three children were born of it. And in the words of Judge Wettstein, and I think this matters greatly, the plaintiff and defendant agreed subsequent to entering the marriage that the plaintiff would not be employed outside the home and that she has not been employed throughout the term of the marriage and that she is thereby currently untrained and underqualified for occupations for which she had previously trained. Judge Broaders, much later on, echoed Judge Wettstein's words and indicated that Ms. Gadpie presented with many symptoms and many diagnoses and said that I think his, Judge Wettstein's, findings reflect mine. I don't find that Ms. Gadpie at this point is reasonably employable given what her health is. So she was basically left with two lifelines. One of them was spousal support, and the other was a portion or a share of Dr. Gadpie's retirement account. Both of these things were significantly decreased by Judge Broaders' two orders in 2017. And you look at the contrast, and this is where life becomes so unfair. Dr. Gadpie is remarried to a woman earning substantial money. They live on a beautiful farm with horses, nine. He's in good health according to his testimony. And he gets all the benefits from Judge Broaders' decisions. So we'll look at the spousal support issues first. Obviously, the first prong of that by 20-109 is a material change in circumstance. And this court and the Supreme Court of Virginia for over 30 years has determined that a voluntary effect that decreases your income is never a material change in circumstance when it's voluntary. And all you have to do is read what Gordon Shapiro, the then attorney, in questioning Dr. Gadpie during the hearing, and it's on app appellant it's on app 134 135 136. And has anyone from the board approached you with regards to having to go on a part-time basis? No. Has anyone in your practice indicated that this was something your practice felt like you should do? No. Had anyone, any physician, indicated to you that physically, medically, you were not able to continue to operate in the manner in which you had all these years? No. Any vocational person? No. Any medical malpractice insurance actuary? No. Is there any rule or regulation regards to having to go part-time when you reach a certain age as part of your practice? No. So this was voluntary on your part.
Let me interrupt you because one of the threshold issues, it seems to me, is whether there was an objection made to the court's jurisdiction. Because obviously, if it's not a material change in circumstances, then the court has no jurisdiction to disturb the prior order.
And Judge Humphreys, that's a great question,
well,
but
no,
I think...
Well, let me finish asking it then.
Oh.
So where in the record is that that objection preserved?
Oh, in several places, Your Honor. First of all, the court noted all of Mr. Shapiro's objections on page 166. And this, of course, as you know, was carried over from a July hearing to an October hearing. So there were two points when the issues were raised by Gordon, Mr. Shapiro, when he was arguing it. But I think the more important part where he raised it was on page 252. And he says, secondly, Dr. Gadpie, having rested in chief, I'd like, for the record, move to strike his evidence on the grounds that he has not borne his burden on the question of material change in circumstances.
I'm talking about the jurisdictional aspects of it. I mean, as I understand in your reply brief, you're arguing that you basically argue that no objection is required because it can't be waived under any circumstances.
Well, I argued that, but I also said he had made objections not only on each order, but before the court, and I just was referring you to one of those that he made in the courtroom, not just on the orders that were then endorsed with objections.
Okay.
So I believe if you look at the appendix on page 252, you'll find that he brought that to the court's attention, and as I said, the court indicated that it was preserving all his objections. Secondly, and really, to me, that's black letter law. And as I said, and I was quoting the Senate bill, but it's now going to be codified as 107.1F. And it's at age 67 that you can now petition a court for material change in circumstance, I guess starting July 1st, based upon a voluntary retirement if you're age 67, Social Security age. And there are a whole bunch of other factors that you have to clear that obstacle.
Well, clearly retirement is a change in circumstances. I think we can all agree on that.
Well, the question is when it's voluntary.
Well, you know, there's some professions. I mean, if I'm working as a welder somewhere and I reach retirement age and choose to retire, you know, I get my gold watch and I wave goodbye to my friends and I walk out the door. But there are some professions, medicine comes to mind, law comes to mind, where, you know, you've got clients and patients to deal with and you're kind of, you know, you're not going to just walk out the door on a particular day. You're going to, you know, work with your clients and work with your patients to transition to retirement over a period of time. And that strikes me as not being an unreasonable approach to retirement. And to the extent that you begin that process, at least at some point in there, it's arguable that you do have a change in circumstances.
And I would say you would need a vocational expert or at least somebody from the practice to have testified to that instead of a self-serving testimony only from Dr. Gadpai and nobody else.
Okay.
There was no other evidence that made it mandatory. In fact, that cross-examination of him by Mr. Shapiro indicates quite otherwise, that it was his decision and his decision alone. But the second part of that is, let's assume that decrease in income is a material change in circumstance, except for the fact that it's really ability to pay. And that was never shown. The only thing that Judge Waters found was that his opportunity and his ability to earn income through practicing medicine. By the way, he was still earning about $260,000 a year. It was not like he was going to the pauper's side of the world. But ability to pay has always been the issue. And that was totally ignored. And we know from the exhibits that were tendered by his counsel through Walter Jones, the forensic expert, that he had over $1 million alone at that point in retirement assets. And the court never addressed that, never addressed any of his other assets, just
now,
addressed...
You focused on those particular words of the trial court. Don't we have a body of jurisprudence that suggests that we don't focus just on the isolated words? We look at the totality of the evidence and overall findings to determine whether or not the trial court has applied the correct standard?
Certainly, but you should see something in the record that reflects that. And there's nothing, I'm not just isolating words, you can look at the whole record and you will see no indication from Judge Broders that he considered the amount of money that Dr. Gadpai at 66 could start taking out of his retirement account. You'll see nothing of that sort. You'll see no considerations of all the mandatory factors in 107.1E. You won't see any of that. You'll see, yes, he says he considered the equitable distribution portion of the case. By the way, there was none. They settled on a contract basis the assets and debts other than a few things they preserved for later on, including spousal support. But there was never an equitable distribution hearing. So when Judge Broder says that, he's totally mistaken. There was no consideration that he could make of an equitable distribution ruling by Judge Weckstein or by Judge Broder because it never happened. I mean, that's very clear from the record. So you can look, Judge Clements, and say, well, is Mr. Rogers just picking this word or that word? But you can look at the entire appendix and the entire transcript, and you won't see any of that. So there are three reasons why the reduction in spouse support is not justified legally. Number one, it was a voluntary decision on the part of Dr. Gadpai to reduce his income. Number two, there's no evidence whatsoever that it reduced his ability to pay. And three, that the factors that are mandatory And this court has said that time and time again. You can say it's not applicable, but you have to address them, are unaddressed. The second issue, of course, is the retirement account. And what Mr. Shapiro argued, and I'll argue to you, is a novation occurred. Now, I understand a fire burned down the house. There wasn't enough insurance. Dr. Gadpie got a lot of orders from the court allowing him to do whatever was necessary to repair the house and incur whatever expenses and then sell the house, and then they had to determine how to reimburse him. Well, there are a lot of ways to do that without rewriting the contract, because the contract clearly, the agreement, clearly presumed that if you're going to offset what she was going to get, what Mrs. Gadpie was going to get from Dr. Gadpie's retirement account, it was going to be a set off of equal amounts from equal amounts. It wasn't going to leave her with much less of a retirement account. And retirement accounts, as this court well knows, are very different than other assets. They're protected in many, many ways from creditors. And what happened here is her ability to access the amounts of which had been agreed to, 50%, set off by a positive, the amount she was going to receive from the sale of the real estate, his half of that. And it's set there in equations. It's set there in Walter Jones, the forensic accountant's indication of exactly what it is. And really, as the court said, the court noted that nobody expected it to be a negative. And that was the intent of the parties that he's talking about at that point. And in Jennings, this court has always said and continued to say that the intent of the parties when interpreting these agreements and executing them and definitely not thwarting them governs. And the judge understood it. And instead, what he did is he put a square peg in a round hole, to quote him. No, you can't do that, because that's not what the parties intended, for a square peg to go in a round hole. And yeah, it was a ball of wax, and it was unforeseen in some ways. And I understood Judge Baldos was trying to get a remedy, but he could have just given a judgment, which could have been dealt with however judgment creditors choose to deal with judgments. But instead, he took away her other lifeline by decreasing it by a huge amount of money. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, my question, I guess, and I assume you're referring to the language in the agreement that refers to net proceeds. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, net proceeds, the dictionary definition is, quote, the amount received in the transaction minus the cost of the transaction, such as expenses and commissions. And if you use that definition, and it's certainly not otherwise defined in the agreement, then it seems to me that that number could be either positive or negative.
I would say that would be something I accept as a logical posit, but for the fact that they actually show the numbers that they're using by reference and showing it as a positive and only as a positive in the actual numerical explanation of how it's going to work. And secondly, it's again going back to what did the parties intend? They never intended, even by Judge Broder's own words, they never intended that it be a negative. They never intended that Mrs.
Well, they never probably planned for it to be a negative, but, I mean, the term net, I mean, the word net preceding the word proceeds suggests that there be, you know, you're not using gross, essentially. You're offsetting expenses or whatever, commissions, whatever it might be, of the sale or transaction, whatever is going on there when you're calculating a profit or loss on the arrangement.
Well, I disagree, obviously, by the argument I'm making, because of the factors that why would she sacrifice for a negative what had been agreed to as her 50% share of Dr. Gadpie's retirement account? That was never contemplated by the parties, never intended by the parties, and that is what governs in interpreting and executing this. And what Judge Baldos did is basically a novation, changed it, and
well,
did.
What's the impact, though, of the July 5, 2011 order?
Well, as I said, Dr. Gadpie was going to be owed money. argue otherwise, but how you effectuate it.
Do the parties agree that the court could determine how he would be paid as otherwise ordered by this court?
Didn't say he could change an agreement that had been ratified by the court. There are other means, and he certainly had other ways of doing it other than violating the terms of the agreement that had been ratified and confirmed by the court. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm going to go ahead and start off, I guess, in the same order that my colleague, Mr. Rogers, did and discuss the spousal support and then move on over to the contract issue that we're dealing with.
Counsel, you are Mr. Potter.
I am. I'm sorry for not introducing myself. A little bit nervous. I've done this one time before, so I apologize for that. But yes, I am Mr. Potter, and I'm happy to be here. So as far as the spousal support, we all know the standard here. As far as the material change in circumstances, I think the court heard the evidence that my client was a 66-year-old anesthesiologist. His own testimony was that he could not continue to do 24-hour shifts, trauma type of cases, and so based on that decision or that understanding of what he could and could not do, he went to his employer and they came up with this arrangement on how to transition into retirement, which he is currently in. I think that's a very reasonable approach to take, not only from a perspective of a business and being a doctor, but it's also, I mean, he testified he could have just said, you know, I'm done, but what he did is he realized he still had an obligation and that he, in order to deal with that, he had to work. And he also testified, quite frankly, he said, I still feel like I have some skills that I can offer to my practice and I can do this, but incident to that, you know, there was a reduction in income. In looking at the record on the reduction in income, I do want to point to the court a couple things. The expert in the case did an analysis, I believe it was B2, and in looking at the income, he said, well, based on his retirement process, there's a 36% reduction in gross income, and then he said, from a cash flow standpoint, if you're looking at where he is as far as the spousal support, it would be a 91% reduction in cash flow. So obviously there was a large reduction in income. But more importantly, and this goes to my colleague Mr. Rogers' point, if you look at that exhibit, it's not just dealing with his income from his practice, whether it's K-1 income or W-2. It's also including dividends. It's also including incomes from royalties. It's also, you know, it's the full gamut of my client's income, which he was obviously required to produce to the court, and he did so, meaning that that is his actual income that he is receiving. Now, there are retirement assets, but there was no evidence provided by either side that there's income. It's not, you know, there was no pensions or anything like that. It's essentially an IRA that has yet to be actually split between our clients. I mean, Ms. Gadpi could have produced, you know, an expert to come in and say, well, at this point he could be taking so much income or selling, you know, so many assets out of his IRA, talked about taxes and what he could be doing and how that would affect the balance of the IRA over his lifetime. She didn't produce any of that evidence. And, you know, essentially I think that what is being argued is that, you know, she didn't produce that evidence in the trial court, and at this point is saying, well, the judge was supposed to somehow figure that out when that was never before the court, other than, well, there is an asset. But what the court did have is a full picture of his income that he was receiving. The other reason why there's no income coming from the retirement asset is he's still working, and he was working at a level where he could still pay a very reasonable amount of spousal support, which was $6,500. To Ms. Gadpi. We do believe that if you look at all the factors, the court said that he looked at all the factors, but the court is not, you know, there's the case law that says, well, the court's not required to go through every single factor and say how exactly they did it. But when the court said I looked at, you know, the factors 1, I believe 3, and number 8, those were the main factors that could have been considered, and the court certainly looked at the evidence, including my client's testimony, Ms. Gadpi's expenses. indicated, hey, look, she still has a need. She still, you know, a lot of her expenses are hard to even kind of understand, but notwithstanding that, due to her conditions, I'm still going to order an amount of spousal support that is consistent with the reduction in my client's income. And I do want to say, and this maybe speak to me as a trial lawyer, the reduction in income was 36%, and the court reduced the spousal support by 19%. And the reason I bring that up is obviously in reducing it, he didn't even reduce it in the full amount of the reduction in income. And I think he did that because he had the issues and he balanced, as he's required to do, the needs of Ms. Gadpie. As far as the contract issue, I will say, and I know Mr. Rogers probably did the same thing, looking for case law for anything like this situation. And I certainly didn't find it. And I think the reason being is that there was a contract where the intent of the parties was for there to be a relationship between the eventual sale of the house, which I think, if I did my math correct, took about 10 years. I don't think anybody envisioned that, and the retirement. That is what the parties contracted for, and that is what they intended. Well, obviously, nobody could foresee a fire. Nobody could foresee Ms. Gadpie's unilateral decision to reduce the amount of insurance coverage. That was the evidence before the court. Nobody could foresee Ms. Gadpie, in my cross-examination of her, testified that she had taken $80,000 to $90,000 of the proceeds and spent it on medical expenses. Of course, that's money that did not go to the house. And the other main thing I did want to point out to the court is that the contract called for $30,000 of the net proceeds to go towards Ms. Gadpie's attorney's fees. And there was nothing we could do to change that. When the house closed, and then the other part of the PSA said, other than that, she was responsible for all of her attorney's fees. So what happened was is she did not pay any of her attorney's fees, and then when the real estate closed, I believe that the attorney ended up receiving somewhere of approximately $138,000 in attorney's fees. So meaning that out of that house, $100,000 or over $100,000 went to pay her attorney's fees that was not bargained for. So essentially based on all of that, then there's an order entered in 2011, which gave my client that basically had to take over the house because that's where Ms. Gadpie was living, and he could, you know, basically fix it up. And the court said, and this was an agreed order, not based on, you know, it was based on the party's agreement, that he would be reimbursed out of the proceeds of the house or as otherwise ordered by the court. And basically what that says is there was an agreement for him to be reimbursed. And that's exactly what Judge Broadhurst did, is follow that order and reimburse my client. And to me, the issue is they're going, well, you know, if he's entitled to be reimbursed, what's the problem with doing it in a manner that is exactly a way that they contracted for in the PSA? I think if the court looks at the PSA and this order, I don't believe that Judge Broadhurst did anything that conflicts with the contract, and at the same time actually gave the party's agreement the life that it needed to deal with this myriad of unforeseen events in order to effectively deal with the party's marital estate, as well as have my client actually get the money that everybody agreed that he was due. For those reasons, I believe that this court should affirm the spousal support reduction and also its interpretation of the contract and its prior agreed order in order to effectively deal with a quagmire, but essentially do what the parties agreed that they would do in both the contract and an order. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Potter. We'll come down and greet counsel.